This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho Moon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
Our traveling fanboys.
When you hear their show, you better run for cover.
Klondike Bill's a sausage lover.
Ooh, our traveling fanboys.
Slobber.
It's a weekly podcast, and you better listen.
Keep your ears in mint condition.
Ooh, our traveling fanboys.
Place to Be Nation. I am your master, your host of festivities, Greg Phillips. And with me along for the ride is my fellow hard-traveling fanboy. He is Nick Duke. We are here to bring you yet another installment of the Long Book Hunters. Nick, how's the safari been today as we've searched for our latest game?
Oh, it's been outstanding. And, you know, I had a very good safari finding the game and looking it over very well. How about yourself?
Well, I would like to say that I myself brought the game to you a long time ago, actually, and you let the game wander and eat grass and get fat before you actually killed the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you killed the game, you didn't actually bring me any of the meat. You brought me imitation meat.
You brought me spoiled meat,
quite frankly.
The rest of that notwithstanding, let's go back to the beginning of your statement. What I actually did was kill the game long ago and let it sit there so long that it reanimated its corpse, and then I killed it again. So I just want you to know that it was killed pretty soon after you brought it to me.
Quite frankly, I would suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that this game is going to be worth the wait, because we are here to review a trade paperback, as we often do in the Long Book Hunters. Nick, I don't know if you knew, that's what we do in this show. We review graphic novels or trade paperback collections. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's one that came out quite some time ago, and that would be called Southern Bastards by
that long ago.
Jason Aaron and Jason Lettier.
First printing October 2014, so a little under 3 years. That's not that long.
Oh, Jason Aaron, but it is still some time ago, would you agree?
You said quite some time ago, implying a long passage of time,
Greg.
It is
quite some time ago. I'd say 3 years is quite some time.
3 years is nothing but a blink of an eye to people such as Todd Weber.
That's true. And to people like us, destined to live short lives, it's an eternity.
An eternity.
It is by Jason Aaron and Jason Lettier, artist extraordinaire.
I thought you were going to try to get over that French pronunciation throughout the entire show. I'm glad to see
you
not.
Would you like me to? I'm going to try it.
I would prefer for you not to, honestly.
I don't care what you prefer.
Then why do you ask me questions, Greg?
I am going to call him for the moment Jason Lettier. And
como,
also Jason
como,
como, como, Jason Lettier and Jason Aaron.
What?
Ooh, we should go for a Beth Moens Jason Aaron.
No, Greg.
Jason Aaron.
No.
He's one of the hardest workers in all of comics.
I haven't heard any Beth Moens this year, and I don't think I'm going to have to, fortunately.
You didn't watch that terrible Monday Night Football game that she did with Rex Ryan?
No, but now I wish I had. Rex Ryan sounds like he probably would have been.
Rex Ryan was brutal. You need to read some of the articles about it. Mm. He was so bad.
Well, the only college football game I should be subjected to on television that she might call is next week's Georgia-Vanderbilt game. So unless she's on the call for that, I should be able to get through the entire season Moen's free. So that would be that.
Sony Michel with the hard yards up the middle. It's going to be great.
It's not. We're hoping that doesn't happen. Didn't we just say that?
Quite frankly. Southern Bastards, ladies and gentlemen, is the name of the book.
You're a Southern bastard.
It has, as are you, it has recently been optioned by FX and will soon, hopefully, be a television series on FX. But that's not the reason we opted to review this book this month, ladies and or gentlemen. The reason we opted to review this here book is because, well, as you all know, Nick and I love wrestling and comic books and wrestling. We love them. We love them just as much as George Wallace loved money and power, power and money in the 1990s George Wallace made-for-TV movie.
I thought you were going to say something far worse than that, but we'll just move on.
No, but we may during the course of the broadcast. God. Because we are here because the other thing that we love in life, ladies and gentlemen, isn't our families. Sure, they're important and all, but they don't play a factor.
They are. Right.
The third thing that we like is foosball. Mm-hmm. Now, that's just what my mama used to call it. But it's actually football. We love it. We love it, Nick. We're from the South. We can't help it. We love fried food. We love football. And we love decades and even centuries of entrenched, deeply held racism that we have to break our way out of as a young child. Is that not accurate, Nick?
I don't know that we love that last thing, but it certainly is a thing.
Certainly. Fried food and football, though, we do love. Fair?
Fair. Fair. A fair point. Can't deny that.
Both things, oddly enough, that will probably have taken years off of our lives.
Oh, there's no doubt of that. There is zero doubt of that at this point. The question becomes, which one, by the end of my life, will have taken more years out of my life? And honestly, I think the football is probably nudging ahead, because you got to think, for me, the football
that's
goes...
A recency bias, though, Nick.
No, the football goes hand-in-hand with the drinking. That's what you got to remember. They tend to coincide. Actually, the football, the drinking, and the tobacco use all tend to go hand-in-hand for me. So I got to think, you know, if you're taking all the associated, you know, effects with it, I think the football has nudged ahead of the fried food at this point.
Probably so, and it's probably like that for me too, because you know, you grow up a Miami Dolphins fan, and then you, it's a different world when you're an Alabama fan, because you hang all your hopes on that team as opposed to any other sporting team that you might care about at a given time. So the reason we bring this up is Southern Bastards is a book that marries two of our three passions. It marries football with comic books. And it does so while also approaching a topic that is almost never approached in comics, which is genuine Southern culture. Genuine because Jason Aaron himself, like us, is an Alabama boy, born and raised.
Like you.
Well, you were born – oh, yeah, that's right. You were born in Hilton. I keep forgetting. But nevertheless, you were very close. You went to school in Alabama, correct?
I did.
Yes, so nevertheless, I stand by the point.
No, you don't stand by the point. I'm not going to be associated with that. You will refer to me as what I am. Close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, you some bitch. I am a proud native of the great state of Georgia, and don't you forget it.
Great state of Georgia. You've already thrown me off my damn trail here. I don't even remember what I was talking about.
You know, you tried to open our podcast with your typical factual inaccuracies. I thought I'd try to correct you once.
No, Jason Latour, who is from, I believe, North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, and I probably am.
No, that's Nick that is accurate.
Game.
That is accurate.
So we've got
it is according to his intro that he wrote for the book.
So we've got two. Stay with me here for this reference, WCW fans. Two wild-eyed Southern boys,
God.
who are young pistols in the comic book industry. I like that, and they're both from the South, so they understand Southern culture in a way that you Yankees don't understand, quite frankly. Nick, fair to say that the Deep South has not been adequately or accurately explored in comic books generally?
Oh, God. I'm trying to think of a comic book that has explored it at all, and I'm having a hard time.
Maybe Preacher, I guess.
I guess Preacher, but that was they confined themselves to mostly Texas and Louisiana, which is a different kind of
Louisiana is a different world, my friend.
A different thing altogether. Like
as,
you know,
as our friend Andrew can attest to,
Creole slash Cajun culture is a unique entity unto itself, as is Texas culture. I mean, after all, it's not a Southern accent; it's a Texas accent. It's different, bro. The point being, I can't really think of a comic that has explored Southern culture. I mean, I guess Preacher, like you said, is the closest thing, but even that was, you know, fairly comical in nature, over the top, certainly playing everything for laughs. Not to say that Southern Bastards doesn't, you know, have its fair share of humor, but I don't think it is. I'll put it this way. It's one of the few things you encounter that isn't making fun of the South, even though it takes place in the South.
Right.
A lot of the things that you encounter, like, I mean, in popular culture, what's probably the most notable depiction of Southern life? It would probably be like, what, Deliverance, you know?
Deliverance, yeah.
Sweet Home Alabama, that terrible, god-awful Reese Witherspoon movie. I'm trying to think of anything else. What was that terrible reality show that was filmed in Dothan there for a little while?
Oh, gosh. I don't even
know. The Trailer
Park
Wives or whatever it was. You know, you remember what I'm talking about, right?
Vaguely.
Bama Bells. Bama Bells is what it was called. I just recalled. Yes, things like that.
Bama Bells. Yeah, man. Well, you know, you're exactly.
We're slapped with that.
Oh, God. Yeah, you're right. It's never been flattering. It's never been accurate for the most part. I mean, you got Rogue and the X-Men, I guess, with the unique accent attributed and whatnot. But I don't really think the comics have ever really, A, sought to, or B, achieved any sort of representation from our region. And so this is a book that goes into it examining, as Jason Aaron has talked about many times, and you actually have the physical book with you, Nick, so you probably can correct me or say it better from the intro, but approaching Southern life from a more holistic point of view, so to speak, to use your parlance from earlier today on our offline conversation, where it's looking to, yes, criticize the stuff that's bad, make fun of the stuff that's silly, but also embrace the stuff that's great about living in the South, because it doesn't suck all the time, folks. There's some cool stuff about living in the South, too. And I think that this book really delves into that and does so in a way that is different, certainly, than what we have traditionally expected. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Absolutely. And I'll read you a couple of excerpts from Jason Aaron's intro that he wrote for the first volume of the series. I won't read the entire thing. I'll just kind of pick and choose here. He opens with, "I love the South. The South also scares the living shit out of me. I love being from the South, but I don't live there anymore, and I don't plan on ever moving back. The South is more peaceful than any place I've ever been, but more primal, too. More timeless, but more haunted. More spiritual, more hateful, more beautiful, more scarred. And that's what this series is about a place you can love and hate and miss and fear all at the same time."
Hey, that says it. Says it pretty perfectly, actually. And all of that rings true. You know, I'm living proof of the old the axiom that Southern born, Southern bred, and one day I'll be Southern dead. I don't see myself ever leaving the Deep South long term. Who knows? Crazier things have happened.
The college
I guess.
Football sucks outside of the South, so why would we want to go anywhere else, Craig?
That's true. It really does. It's not good,
especially now that we get Southern WrestleManias. I mean, what motivation is there to leave? Really?
Absolutely not. I mean, I don't want to be stuck watching Iowa and Penn State have their, you know, 15 to 16 games or whatever. So, you know.
Big 10 speed, Greg. Big 10 speed.
Big 10 speed. Big 10 speed and Big 12 power.
My God. You can always move to the Northeast and just talk about the Yankees 365 days out of the year.
Hey, that might make our stock rise in the Place to Be Nation, my friend. The Yankees, my friend. The Yankees winning with all the Braves' old prospects. I made that up. I don't know if any Braves prospects are actually with the Yankees, but
I don't believe so. But
that would require knowing something about baseball.
I was about to say I honestly haven't followed it closely enough to you know, football season started. What the hell do I give a crap about baseball's postseason?
Yeah. Baseball and its lack of permanent head injuries.
That's right. or a general anyway. Corruption level.
Anyway. Hey, basketball's catching up, though.
Hey, yeah, we'll be there before we know it.
Anyway, we're getting way offline here. The point being, this is a book that is about, as the title implies, Southern
bastards who are indeed from the South.
South, yes, and it means those both literally and figuratively, because as is the case, a lot of small Southern towns have a lot of bastards. That's just a fact. Nick, you now, worked at a newspaper too. You know this to be
the
true.
The important question is, are they fatherless bastards?
Chris Lieben was a fatherless bastard, according to the first season of The Ultimate Fighter. Again, these are documented facts. These are not statements about the man's character from Greg Phillips. This was documented by that guy whose name I forgot that called Chris Lieben a fatherless bastard. And launched the brand of the UFC.
What are we doing with our lives right now?
What I'm doing is long-winded. We're long-windedly introducing the Southern Bastards concept. So this takes place in a town in Alabama. It's basically insert small town here, Alabama.
Right. Yeah, because Crow County is not a place as far as I'm aware.
It's a fictitious. Yeah. It is a fictitious location, and it is Craw County, Alabama. But they do, oddly enough, mention locations such as Wetumpka is one of their rivals, which is a real Alabama town. And there's some real cities mentioned in it, real towns mentioned in it,
come from Wetumpka, but steers and queers. Put it that way.
I'm not touching that with a 45-and-a-half-foot pole. But what I am going to touch...
Will you touch it with a 3-and-a-half-inch pole?
Well, that's the only kind of pole that I have to touch it with, so...
Well, Lord knows you've touched things from Wetumpka with a 3-and-a-half-inch pole. I'll put it that way.
Oh, doctor!
Is that your Keith Jackson impression?
Yes!
That's awesome! Oh, man, we are on it tonight.
Yes, we are. And Keith Jackson, known worldwide as one of the great football commentators, would approve of Southern Bastards because it takes a hard and fast approach at another topic that has not been very realistically realized in comic books, which is football. Nick, football has been covered in comics for, decades, probably going back to the Golden Age, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. But typically, it's been limited to just a panel here or there, a generic shot of a quarterback throwing the football or getting hit or shot with an arrow or something.
Yeah, whenever DC tells Cyborg's origin, that's typically the most you get in terms of football from a comic. I'm trying to think of other places where it would be notable.
I mean, it showed up in one of the recent Green Arrow issues that I read.
Oh, yeah, you're right. They were at a football game.
Guy Gardner was a football player.
Yeah,
right.
Some of the old Ultimate Fantastic Four stories had Ben Grimm on the field and stuff like that. So yeah, I guess you get it here and there. I guess Cyborg is the one of all the comics characters I most closely associate with football, because I believe most incarnations of his origin have the actual accident happening to him on the football field. Do they not?
I wouldn't know. I haven't read the.
Just say yes, and we'll move on.
Booked origins of Cyborg outside of the New 52. So, but yes, I will say yes. And, okay. But typically it's very generic stuff. It's like he gained yards running, or he gained yards throwing, or he is a star and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, this book wants to take you more into football culture. And for those that have never lived in the South, you don't really understand how much it's ingrained in you from the time that you're a small child. Mm-hmm. Nick, I don't know about you, but by the time I was 10 years old, I knew what an audible was.
Yeah,
I knew what formations were. I knew what, I knew when to be upset at the offensive coordinator or the defensive coordinator for calling plays.
Absolutely.
You know?
And this is something you probably didn't have as much experience with because you grew up in Florida and then eventually moved. But it's not just, college football I would say pro football, but that's not really a thing in the South, at least in the deep South, at least in the predominantly white South, let's put it that way. college football definitely ingrained in you from a young age, but as we will discuss here in this book, so too from a local perspective is high school football. Very much beaten into you from a young age. And I'm sure you probably didn't have the same experience because you didn't kind of grow up in or around the same area your entire childhood, so it probably wasn't this this thing that you learned from an ultra young age. But definitely when I was coming up, you know, all the little small towns, I mean, there was nothing else going on Friday nights, and that's where everybody was on Friday night. You know, that's where I spent God knows how many Friday nights over the course of my childhood. My brother was a you know, pretty decent high school football player in his day. So during my young years, in the 3, 4, 5, that kind of thing, spent a lot of nights watching him play and stuff. So, yeah, high school football, college football, those two predominantly, you know, major aspects of Southern life. Pro football, not really as much. I can't really explain why that is. If you're actually in the cities of, like, New Orleans or Atlanta, you might have it. I guess now in Nashville, right, the Titans, you might have it. But really, I guess for the most part, it's just not – it is not a regional thing the way that
right,
college and high school football are.
And it is interesting too, because you could say, you know, you say, well, you know, most southern states don't really have pro teams, which is true.
Which used to be the case, but that's not really the case anymore, because now you look Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee. I mean,
you know, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, places like that don't have it, but. When you look at something like the Braves, where that feels like it's a unified kind of Southern cultural thing. Like if you're in the Southeast, you're pretty much a Braves fan, right, like by default.
Right.
But that doesn't really apply to pro football for whatever reason. And, you know, I can't explain that either. But I know that high school football, that was kind of a crash course for me, having gone to the school that I went to was in a pretty big city by Alabama standards, and we were terrible at football. But when I got my newspaper job is when I really realized how big high school football is in the state and this region. Because like you said, Nick, these small towns, everybody's there on Friday night. And some of these small town football games are like serious business. And not just serious business in terms of the people taking it seriously, but like big business. Lots of money in concessions, lots of money in ticket sales. There's shirts sold at the games and stuff. It's insanity, but it's intense, and the level of play is very high, and the expectations for the people that are involved of getting their sons to college on the basis of their football skill is high.
Well, God, so, I mean, Greg, you remember when we were coming up. I mean, that was during the time of two-a-days. There was literally an MTV reality show about Alabama high school football. I mean, I wish I could explain it. I think what I would say, if I had to guess, and this could apply to college football as well, I feel like people in the South tend to be more stationary than people in other parts of the country. I feel like people in the South don't tend to stay here and tend not to leave and migrate as much as people from other areas of the country. And so I feel like there's this enhanced sense of local pride. Maybe that's it. Maybe mm-hmm. it isn't, but that's just kind of the sense I've gotten. Cause you know, I've been away from my hometown now for God, let's see, practically 11, 12 years now. And the rare occasions I do make it back, I go to a football game and it's like, it's the same people I saw there 11 or 12 years ago, you know? It's just one of those things I've noticed.
And it's also one of those things that it's hard to explain to people, but one of the other unique aspects of living in the South is you don't have a lot to be proud of. Like, you really don't. Like, you have a messed up history. You have not a lot of major economic industries. You have
generations older than you who are clinging with dear life to that messed up history and insisting it's the greatest thing ever. So you have
right.
– it's just – it's a weird place to live.
So you don't have pro sports teams, you know. Sometimes if you live in the Northeast, you know, you have 6, 7 pro sports teams to choose from. If you live on the West Coast, you have, you know, 3 NFL teams or however many baseball teams at this point to choose from. When you live in the Deep South, you don't really have that, and so especially locally, that you can go to entertain yourself on a weekend or whatever. So these high schools and these local sports and college sports become your pro sports, become your recreation, become your big concert venue. They become your gathering place for recreation, for entertainment, and it becomes this the one thing that your community can hang its hat on and unify together and say, hey, we got this. We may not have this, but we've got this. We may be 49th out of 50 in education, but by God, we'll beat your ass on the football field. You know what I mean? Like, we may have terrible roads that never get fixed, but damn it all, our high school team has been state champion 4 out of 5 years.
It's like the old saying goes, Greg, the best thing that ever happened to the state of Alabama is the state of Mississippi.
Absolutely, Papio Daniel Gumner. But, you know, and it's like that throughout the South. You know, it's not just Alabama, but I think, you know, that's what I know best is the Alabama philosophy, but it's the same way in Mississippi or I'm sure Georgia,
definitely.
You know,
it's interesting in how it seems to degrade a little bit when you're in larger urban areas. You know,
right.
I will say that, like, I feel like that cultural aspect of it is a little bit less in somewhere like Atlanta or Birmingham compared to somewhere like where I grew up, which is you know, the smallest of small towns.
Absolutely,
yeah, and currently ranked number 4 in the state in Class 1A in Alabama. By the way,
Shout out to the undefeated
Houston County Lions.
They're doing well. They're doing well. And you know, and not to – I don't know. I actually don't know how my old high school is doing right now. But I know that after I left – I'm not saying that these two things had anything to do with one another. But after I left high school, almost immediately thereafter, my high school became good at football.
I'm pretty sure those two things are related.
So, shut your mouth! So anyway, we should probably talk
Greg,
about
how many women
bastards.
Have you slept with?
What? I'm not answering that. What are you talking about?
I don't know. I thought we were praising people for how many women they've slept with. I thought that was the nature of the week. Your Ric Flair impression spurred the question. I apologize.
Oh, I got you. Although Ron Jeremy says that's not possible.
What does Wilt Chamberlain say about it?
Chamberlain's dead, my friend. Wilt Chamberlain ain't saying shit.
What did Wilt Chamberlain say about it back in the day?
Well, back in the day?
What does Wilt Chamberlain's Futurama head say about it?
I'd rather not comment.
What are we
on
doing
that?
With our lives right now?
We should be talking about Southern Bastards.
We have not said a word about the actual comic.
We have been doing an audio think piece about Southern cultural heritage.
There we are. That no one will understand or appreciate.
No. But what we will talk about now is Southern Bastards. Now, this is a book that centers – let us be clear. We're doing the Long Book Hunters here. We are reviewing Volume 1, Here Was a Man. Southern Bastards Volume 1, Here Was a Man. And this collects, I believe, Nick, the first 4 issues or 5 issues.
One through 4.
Issues 1 through 4 of this Image Comics series. And one of the many cool things about Image when they launch new series is they get the trades out almost immediately, like very quickly, and they're very cheap. It's like $10 for the trade.
Yeah,
so
$9.99 cover price on this one, and that was in 2014. So I would assume you probably get this one. You know, I don't know what it would be, but I would assume $7 or so on Amazon, probably somewhere in that in that neighborhood. Yeah, but. You know, like you said, though, they cover 4 issues, and I feel like maybe a lot of their series do that on purpose, like have their initial story arcs be a little bit shorter so they can get those titles, like you said, hurry up and get them out the door. $7.02 in paperback right now on Amazon, so
incredible.
Hell of a deal. If you go digital, it's $3.99 for the first volume. So,
the big question you may be having right now is what exactly is Southern Bastards about? And we've talked about it being about Southern culture, about it being about football, but really this first volume is about a character named Earl Tubb, which is a great Southern name. Would you agree, Nick?
Oh, it's a fantastic Southern name. It's one of the best I've heard.
Earl Tubb is it is a phenomenal Southern name. He is
almost as good as Ernest Tubb.
Ooh, now we're getting into a little bit of whispering Bill Anderson territory there with some country crooners for the past. We mentioned it takes place in Craw County, Alabama, where Ernest Tubb – now I'm going to call him Ernest Tubb the whole time. Earl Tubb escaped from this small town. He got a job with I believe, Nick, you're going to have to fill in some of the blanks here. It's been a while since I've actually read it.
Okay.
But he got a job in a bigger city, Birmingham, maybe, working for the state, I think.
Yeah,
and
set up near Birmingham. I don't remember what his actual job was, but yes.
But got out of his small town. He grew up the son of this small town sheriff, and he had a very bad relationship with his dad. His dad was kind of like a guy who tried to make a stand for something, tried to be a hard ass sheriff, and ended up getting killed for it. And Earl got out of Craw County, said he would never go back, hated it there. But as it turns out, he left. He went to Vietnam, disliked his dad. He comes back when his uncle Buell is no longer able to take care.
His uncle who?
His uncle Buell, mm-hmm. Buhl, or is it Bull? I can't.
No, Buell's fine. I wonder, Greg, if a certain wrestling announcer would pronounce that name, what it would sound like.
Uncle Buell.
Okay, thank you.
Now, Earl Tubbs, Uncle Buell. Well, quite frankly, he knew somebody named Dusty Tutwiler. anyway, so.
Oh, God, Greg. Jim Ross needs to play Earl Tubb in the Southern Bastards television show.
Ooh. I would buy that for a dollar. Because Earl Tubb's an older man. He is. He's an older man.
Is Jim Ross not an older man?
Absolutely. No, that's why I'm saying it would work. That is why I'm saying it would work.
And they could really stretch it out, because then he could take up entire episodes just with the voicemails he's leaving his daughter.
Now, listen here, daughter. Now, you, if you would like, can come back into my life at any time. You're welcome. That's your right. That is your right. However, if you'd like not to do it, that too is your right. Maybe I'd like you to, though. Maybe I want to see you again. Then again, maybe I don't. What do you think I would like to do? Folks, it's like this. And another thing that I'm getting tired of is the lack of selling in this relationship.
In any event, so the book pretty much circles around this guy, Earl Tubb, who has come back to his hometown many years after leaving. His father has passed away. His uncle, Buell, was living in his father's home, and now his uncle has been placed into a nursing home. So he has come back to pack up his family's belongings and get the hell out of Dodge, essentially. Put the house up for sale, get everything out of the way, and just never look back at this small town. But while he's there, he has memories of his father having been the local sheriff, his father having taken a stand against various criminal elements in the town back when Earl was a young boy. And he notices now that without his father there, these criminal elements have run wild. There seems to be a player in town known only as Boss, who seems to be controlling most of the local economy, whether it's running the local hardware store, the local barbecue restaurant. Basically, all the things you would need in a small town seem to all be running through this individual Boss, and he notices just a general decline in the state of his hometown. And over the course of the series, he feels this pull, a call to action, if you will, because of the legacy of his father, and he has to wrestle with that. In fact, it gives him something to wrestle with.
Nick?
Southern Bastards.
Big Pop.
So anyway, yeah, he has to wrestle with this call to action, and eventually we see his conscience gets the better of him, and it leads him into all kinds of trouble as he discovers that this individual Boss is not just the most powerful economic man in the county. He is also the most powerful cultural man in the county. That being because he is the local high school football coach. And ain't nobody in no small town as powerful as the local high school football coach.
Absolutely. And his name in this case is Euless Boss.
What a fantastic, these just great Southern names, man.
They really are. And the thing to – I want to add one addendum to your comment, though, Nick. There ain't nobody as powerful in a small Southern town as the high school coach as long as he's winning.
As long as he's winning. That's true. And then the gas station gossipers take over as the most powerful men in the town.
Great point. And in this town, Euless Boss is revered. He is – he is as revered as Bear Bryant or Nick Saban or somebody like that in the state of Alabama would be. So he's very – he's held on a high level, somewhere approaching the level of right on some days above, on some days below, their reverence for someone like, I don't know, God. So he runs everything, and everybody looks up to him and is afraid of him in some cases. So in the course of this story, Earl sees some things going on, as you mentioned, that he doesn't like. He runs into a character named Dusty Tutwiler, who owes money to Coach Boss and is about to get roughed up by some of the football players, including another great name, Esau Goings.
Yes.
And Earl roughs that guy up and saves Dusty. But Dusty ends up getting killed anyway, murdered by Coach Boss's thugs and the former football players that kind of hang around the town. And we all know, you know, what Southern Bastards is, it's not claiming to be a direct and super accurate representation of a Southern town, but it is a slightly exaggerated Southern town turned up to 11, if you will, because there's not a lot of cover. I don't think there's a lot of covered up murders from the ex-football players hanging around and stuff. But what you do see in these small towns are guys whose biggest high point in their lives was being a star high school football player.
Yep.
And they still walk around wearing their jersey from the high school, and they still remind you all the time of their high school stats. And they still walk around, you know, with that swagger that they're still in high school, you know, and you see that all over the place. And it's no different here in Craw County. You see that with a lot of these characters where these figures that when they go outside, they're a nobody. But as long as they keep that jersey on, they feel like they're still that star who was putting up numbers on Friday nights.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they kind of talk about that. They even mention at one point that, you know, Earl himself was a star athlete. But him having left Craw County many years ago, you can kind of see how he looks back on his time as, you know, with some sort of disdain or disgust or shame, while as everybody else looks back on those times as the proudest moments in their lives. So they do a good job of setting up that juxtaposition between, you know, Earl and the other people who chose to stick around Craw County.
Yeah, and Earl actually had a past with Euless Boss. They were classmates together in school or skewl, and at that time Earl was the more popular one, and Euless was not considered much at that time.
Whenever they do the Southern Bastards television show, the theme song should be the Ballad of Euless Boss. I think that would be good.
I think that would be good. Who should sing the Ballad of Euless Boss?
Jerry Reed's still alive, is he not? Or he died?
No, I think he died recently.
Oh,
yeah.
God. Everyone good is dying, Greg. It sucks.
Yeah, you're right. Everything just sucks.
That's...
But.
Life
but,
sucks.
And then you die. maybe Vince McMahon could play Euless Boss.
You know what doesn't suck, Greg?
What's that?
Hilton Hulkamaniacs.
Oh, for God's sake. It's a, what is it you always used to tell me, Nick?
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy football is not a sprint. Mm-hmm. It is a marathon. Mm-hmm. Hilton Hulkamaniacs, lowest scoring top seeded team in the history of fantasy football. you all right there, Paul? You know, one day, Paul's going to inhale too hard, and he's going to have to get nasal surgery.
All I'll say is this, Greg. I am one good Saturday away from being September and O, a combined 10-0 in the collegiate, professional, and fantasy ranks.
You shouldn't have said it, Nick.
I said it, Greg.
You shouldn't have said it. You just jinxed it.
I don't care.
You just jinxed the human... It. The human blockhead himself might have something for you on Saturday.
Sergeant Carter.
Kick me in the jimmy!
Oh, yeah!
Do it again! Harder! Yes! Whoa.
This is probably the most like tangential podcast I think we've ever done. And that covers a lot of ground. We have spent more time just kind of meandering our way through life than we have actually talking about this book.
And another individual who spent much of his time meandering his way through life is Tad, who is a rather interesting young man.
Who seems to be the Southern Bastard equivalent of Jesse's young friend from Preacher. Billy Bob.
Billy Bob the Cyclops.
Except with two eyes. If Billy Bob had two eyes, he would be Tad from Southern Bastards, essentially.
Yeah, Tad's not the sharpest knife in the drawer.
He ain't the brightest crayon in the box.
He's lived his whole life in Crock County.
And that's saying something in a book like Southern Bastards. If I can read this book and go, this guy ain't the brightest crayon in the box, what does that really say about him?
He's a big fan of the Running Rebs, which is the name of the football team, the Running Rebs. And he's especially fond of a shirt that you see will pop up on occasion, which is Sweet Tea, which is a diabetes-inducing sweet tea pitcher that is on T-shirts throughout the Southern Bastards universe. Little nods and logos thrown in there by Jason Latour. So Tad is a young boy, and he's sitting there watching TV when the Running Rebs come to Earl Tubbs' home to get a little bit of payback on him, and Tad ends up getting beaten nearly to death by the football team, and that's finally what gets Earl to realize he needs to do something about this coach boss issue. And he does. He tries to. He thinks that ultimately, at the end of the day, no matter what hold Coach Boss has over this town, that the people of the community will rise up and that they just need to be inspired. They need to be reminded of who the hell they are and what right and wrong is, and that they can't be bossed around, so to speak, and pushed around by Coach Boss. So he confronts Coach Boss publicly and thinks that he can get the town to rally behind him, and has a knockdown, drag-out fight with Coach Boss. Unfortunately, doesn't end in the best way for old Earl.
No, it does not. Yeah, he actually has to I think, Greg, you're putting things a little bit out of order. What actually happens is, you know, Dusty, the murder of Dusty spurs him into a little bit of action, then Tad's injuries only strengthen his resolve. So he actually has a run-in with the aforementioned Esau Goings a couple of times in the early issues, once defending, saving Dusty's life by hitting Esau in the face with a deep fryer, which is a pretty awesome scene.
Yeah.
And then the second time, beating the ever-living hell out of him with a big stick, which is also cool.
Yep.
There's a dramatic scene where we keep seeing this image of Earl's father carrying this stick when he was sheriff. And his father is buried beneath this giant old oak tree on the Tubb property. One night, Earl is having a shouting match with his father's spirit, essentially standing at his grave, yelling at his father for all the perceived wrongs of his life and how he's not going to stick around here and get sucked into this town the same way his father did. The tree is struck by lightning, and out from his father's grave is thrown his father's stick. So Earl picks it up and takes it as a sign to take action. And so he heads down into the local, into the community, has another run in with Esau Goings where he beats the hell out of him, fights through his way through the entire, coach boss's entire, gang essentially to get inside the barbecue restaurant where there sits Coach Boss. And they have, what is really the climactic showdown of this first volume.
Absolutely. And it's very Walking Tall, is it not? It's very
and I think
Buford T. Justice.
Yes, I think that's on purpose. I think it's clear that Walking Tall was one of the big influences on this one.
I'm actually wrong. The actual original Walking Tall character from the 70s that was based on a real guy, I guess, was Buford T. Pusser. I knew I'd pop you with that.
Pusser.
Yes, the original Walking Tall is based on the real-life Sheriff Buford Pusser.
Well, if Jameis Winston ever had a run-in with Buford T. Pusser, he would say, hit him right in the pusser.
He would. He would. But nonetheless, Nick, before we get to our thoughts on that climactic battle, we've danced around the issue a lot, but I think one of the things that I'm hoping people can get out of this is this, at least I can't speak for you, but from my perspective, this was such a refreshing book to read. Like, it gets football right. It gets Southern culture right, because the food, the barbecue joints,
right,
in this town, you
and
know.
And that's the thing. Like, I think people, whenever we in the South complain about things in pop culture not representing the South accurately, I think a lot of people who aren't from here think that we want it to be glorified or put up on some pedestal. And that is not at all like what we're looking for. At least that's not what I'm looking for. I want it to be believable. I want it to be at least somewhat. I'm not asking for like photorealism by any stretch of the imagination, but I want something that I can recognize in whatever the piece of art may be, whether it's a, you know, television show, a movie, or in this case a comic. And that means capturing some of those uglier parts of the South, but doing it in a way that feels authentic and doesn't feel over the top or feel like it was made by someone with no real understanding of what the ugliness here actually looks like. It's very rare in this part of the country that you encounter overt ugliness. It's that kind of ugliness that sneaks around behind your back. You know, it's that
right.
kind of ugliness that is that people, you know, the what I call the bless your heart ugliness. You know, where people will say things that and couch them in positive ways, but really they're essentially insulting you to your face. At least that's my experience as a white
right.
individual growing up in the South. I'm sure people of color and you know people who are minorities have had vastly different experiences than that. But I can say that this passes that test for me because it captures a lot of the elements of the South, good and bad, mostly bad, admittedly, in this first volume. But that's okay with me because it feels like a
authentic.
It feels like a town I can recognize, even if it's not one exactly like the one I grew up in.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's authentic. It's not that sort of
it's not a caricature, is what I guess.
Right,
is what I'm trying
exactly.
to say.
It's it's a little exaggerated, but it's not over the top, like you mentioned. It's not too. It's not an outsider's warped perspective of the South, if that makes sense. It's not the person who's been in I don't know in Chicago his whole life, and he comes down to. He just randomly flies into Columbia, Alabama, and writes and you know draws a picture of what he thinks Columbia, Alabama is, and it's this warped, distorted thing. It's something that you can realize if you're down here, and for people that haven't been here, it's much more accurate to what life is like in the South than what you often see in pop culture. To Nick's point, it's much more there's beauty and there's terror. There are the nicest people that you'll ever meet, and then there are the ugliest and most offensive aspects of people that you'll ever encounter. They're, you know, hospitality versus hate. You know, it's just there's all of these dualities going on. People are amazing, and people are assholes, and sometimes they're both at exactly the same time.
Right.
And this book does a great job of capturing that and takes you on an interesting journey as well. It's not just mood pieces. It's not just setting the stage, setting the tone. It's also putting in characters that you find yourself attached to, some that are funny, some that are scary, some that are, in the case of Earl Tubb, instantly recognizable and relatable. Because another thing that people in the Deep South, at least of our ilk, can relate to is issues of family and often feeling at odds with your own family, the people you love, but the people that you also have aspects about them that you hate. And that's very much what Earl Tubb deals with this whole time. This again, I don't want to speak for you, Nick, but this duality that sometimes you feel in yourself
yeah,
as a Southerner,
definitely, yeah.
of pride versus shame, love versus dislike, even within your own feelings with your own family. So it does such a great job, better than I would say anything that I've read that's tried to tackle this area or this region, at least in comic book form, of capturing those things and making you realize with Earl Tubb, this character that could very well be an older version of us, you know, and it's just instantly attractive as a reader. It draws you in. The art's great. The writing is on point. The dialogue is authentic and believable. From Earl to, you know, all these weirdly named characters that are amazing. Coach Boss is
that are only weirdly named if you've never lived here. Because
exactly.
We all know people with crazy names like this.
We all have people in our family with crazy names like
let
this.
Let it never be forgotten for those of you who never have lived in the South. To just give you just a taste to let you know these kind of names do exist. Always remember, the Detroit Lions offensive coordinator is named Jim Bob Cooter.
Jim Bob Cooter.
And that's pretty indicative of about 3 to 5% of the names of people here in the South. That's a real thing.
Absolutely. There is I'm going to tell some tales out of Skeel. There is a local Coffee County, Alabama, a local Coffee County commissioner, longtime commissioner, whose name is Burnest Toe Brooks.
Burnest
Toe Brooks. And that, you know, that's just the guy that had the really funny name. I keep wanting to say it's something related to alcohol.
Boozer Downs.
Boozer. Young Boozer. That's it.
Young Boozer. Yep.
Young Boozer was a state politician.
That's a real name, folks. That's not just a nickname. That is his actual name. First name Young, last name Boozer.
So, as you can see, there are great things about living in the South.
Yes.
You get awesome names. So, this book does a great job of capturing all of that, Nick. And I thought that the characters were awesome. The locale was awesome. And it had me interested the whole way. It was almost like watching Walking Tall, mm-hmm. whether it be the original or whether it be the rock version, where, something that is short and to the point, and you're instantly left thinking, man, I want to see where this goes.
Yeah, and the main reason you want to see where it goes is because the villains of the piece are so damn hateable that you just want to see them get their heads kicked in. And unfortunately, you don't get that here in the first volume. But, you know, the story has to have somewhere to go. So it's clear that, based on this first volume anyway, that Coach Boss has got a death grip on this town, and shaking it loose is not going to be an easy thing to do.
That's the thing. I want to get to that because I think one of the most powerful aspects of this book and what made it stick with me for a long time is that last chapter and that knockdown dragout we talked about between Tubb and Boss. And it does not end the way I thought it was going to end, Nick.
No, me neither. But I guess, again, it makes sense given the fact that It's only the first volume. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you,
I loved it.
You can't blow it off there. You got nowhere to go.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was going to turn into. I thought he was going to whoop Coach Boss, and then it was going to turn into a book about Earl Tubb trying to turn this town around, mm-hmm. And dealing with people along the way. But as it turns out, Coach Boss is not a typical comic book villain that's going to be defeated in one comic book story arc.
No.
He is far too powerful, far too established, and I was stunned. I don't want to spoil it for those that haven't read it because it is a huge shock when it happens. Stunned by the finish of this book, the way it ends. And we also find out about our lead character that he has a mixed-race daughter, which is going to make things only more interesting, I can assume, from here on out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Bastards. Absolutely. So it definitely has me chomping at the bit to read a little bit more and see where this goes.
Oh, for sure. So with all that being said, folks, I feel like we haven't talked about Southern Bastards as much as we should. Admittedly, I haven't read it in a while. I wasn't able to get my hands on an actual copy of the book again. But I did read it and love it a couple years ago, and Nick has read it recently, and we both loved it. I mean, yeah. I have to give it a high recommendation, Nick.
Yes, exceedingly high, both for those of you who are from the South and want to see a more relatable interpretation of it, and for those of you who aren't from the South and want to see something that is not a caricaturized version of the South. This one has mine and Greg's Southern seal of approval, so check it out.
Y'all just need to check it out and and just let us know if you want any refreshments from inside. We'll bring you some sweet tea. We'll bring you some lemonade. We'll bring anything you want.
Is that are you doing unnamed Place to Be Nation personalities as Dr. Manhattan from comic book theater?
No comment, sir. I was just trying to do a random.
You know, I've heard that other Place to Be Nation personalities are attempting to do certain other Place to Be Nation personalities as Rorschach on recent podcasts. So I figured you were just returning the favor.
Yeah, no, that's okay though. I don't like to lick batteries.
I'll stick to my own contributions, whatever they may have been to comic book theater.
I think it mainly boiled down to one long F-bomb.
That's a fair representation of my entire life to this point, Greg. So let's just, you know, what can I say?
Oh, speaking of life in the South. This book gets my highest recommendation as well. Mm-hmm. Check it out. For $7.50 or whatever.
$7.02 in the paperback, $3.99 on Kindle, or Comixology. So, I mean, $4, basically 99 cents an issue if you want to check this out. Hard to beat that. If you're a digital reader, $7.02, I mean, that is a hell of a deal. That's a deal right there.
That's right. Like $4 PBRs.
That's right.
There is no excuse not to check this book out, folks. It's great. I know it was Russell's book of the year that we did awards when this came out. So check it out. It's worth the wait. It's worth the time and investment. And I know Nick and I were talking today about how excited we are to see where the story goes and to read the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey might say. So with that being said, we're going to take a break right after we remind you that you are listening to the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We hope that you're still with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'd like to apologize for our long, rambling, nonsensical, non sequitur filled first half of the show. We talked a little bit about Southern Bastards and a lot about all kinds of other BS, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But we would like to invite you, if you would like to let us know your opinions on Southern Bastards, both in real life and the comic book, then let us know. Maybe we're Southern Bastards, but tell us that. Tweet us at JRsBBQ, at GPhillips8652, and of course at NickDuke87. Email us at GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com, or even more preferable than that, join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Simply open up your browser or your Facebook app and go to the search bar and type in Place to Be Nation Comics. We'll let you in. It'll be a great time. Now, it's time for our weekly look at the news and notes of the comic book world. It's time once again for the rundown.
Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Oh, my boy. So excited about the rundown this week. We've got a lot to talk about. Not a whole lot, but a lot. And we are going to kick things off with the most anticipated, and I don't think this is overstating it, Nick, the most anticipated television event of the year. And that is ABC's upcoming debut of Marvel's Inhumans. Because apparently there are concerns from the studio, based on the bad reviews for the show. There's no way around it. And the void on the street, as the kids say, is that it's bad.
It weren't good, is the idea.
It weren't good. And as part of that, there's also a report that ABC was originally going to cancel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but Disney stepped in and forced their hand and said, you have to keep Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. alive for its next season. Although Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. will be taking over for Inhumans in January on Friday nights. So the shakiness of the Marvel TV situation on ABC is indeed shaky, it appears, Nick.
Yes, the shakiness of the situation is indeed shaky.
Mm-hmm. I mean, your thoughts on Inhumans and on the report about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. report is very strange. I mean, I don't understand why Disney would want to save a show that its network is not really invested in.
When they didn't fight at all for Agent Carter.
Well, come on, Greg. Let's not be naive there. Like, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is a show that has white male leads on it in the form of Phil Coulson, and purports, at least anyway, to have connections to its ultra-successful Marvel Cinematic Universe. So it makes sense that they want – I mean, they didn't save Agent Carter because they didn't care. Agent Carter was a fill-in, and they didn't care how good it was.
You almost said Agent Farter, I wish you had.
That would have been awesome. That's the show they should make next is Agent Farter. That would be great.
Yeah, starring Natalya.
Yeah. Oh, there that is. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. I don't really get that, why they would force another season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but, you know, who knows? I'm not watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. anymore, so those of you who still are, maybe you'll enjoy it. I hope you do. As far as Inhumans goes, are any of us surprised? Like, anybody who has followed not just the production of this show, but the development of it from a concept. Like, it was supposed to be a film. You know, it got caught up in the Marvel Civil War, the real life, you know, back bullshit politics in the back between Kevin Feige and Ike Perlmutter. Kevin Feige ultimately won that power struggle. And so Perlmutter, you know, took his ball and went home and decided, you know what, I'll just do my Inhuman show over here, and forced it upon the television side when they didn't really want to do it either. The trailer that came out at Comic-Con looked awful. It seemed like the entire thing was rushed from the get-go just to get it onto the screen because they wanted to meet that early September time frame because that was the only weekend that IMAX didn't have anything major releasing and didn't mind putting it into the theaters for a shameless cash grab. And the whole thing just seems like it's been a disaster from the get-go. So I'm not surprised the reviews are awful. Also, the Inhumans are a really boring concept that no one gives a shit about. So that makes for a bad situation. So is anyone surprised by the terrible reception that Inhumans has received to this point and is likely to receive when it debuts?
Apparently it has caused friction between ABC and Disney. Here's a quote from Slash Films' Peter Scaretta reviewing some scenes of the show that were screened at Comic-Con in July. Quote, "Wow, Inhumans looks worse than I ever possibly could have imagined. Badly written, horrible costumes, cheap-looking designs, film school-level-looking visual effects, unmotivated overlit cinematography, unnecessary slow motion shots. The crowd laughed at the footage." End quote. And here's another bit, Nick, that I'm not sure if you knew about. Do you know who the showrunner and head writer of Inhumans is?
Scott Buck, the same showwriter and showrunner and head writer of Iron Fist.
Indeed.
I did know that.
And early reviews have indicated that this is, and this is a quote from a Twitter review, even worse than Iron Fist. So
you still got to watch Iron Fist. I'm going to hold you to that.
In her review of Inhumans for Variety, critic Maureen Ryan wrote, quote, "Iron Fist looks like Citizen Kane next to this slapped together, incoherent, cheap-looking mess." End of quote.
We have got to watch this, Greg. We have to watch this.
Tony Dungy of the Houston Chronicle.
Wait a minute, Tony Dungy?
Says, "Inhumans makes Gandhi look like a child pornographer."
Did he actually write that?
No, it's a reference. It's a reference to the
I know what it's a reference to. I was hoping that, that he wrote it in his column in an attempt to make that reference.
The Tony Dungy reference is actually a reference to the old the Robert Goulet Red Ships of Spain sketch from SNL, because it always said, "Tony Dungy of the Houston Chronicle said, at one point I got up on stage in a dazed state."
And just walked around, and no one seemed to notice.
No one seemed to notice or care.
Red Ships
of Spain. Red Ships of Spain.
One of the more bizarre.
Be written. For reasons undetermined.
Oh, Scott Jorgensen, I love it.
I love it. Anyway, let's get away from the Inhumans. We're dreading that, obviously.
No, I'm very much looking forward to it at this point. I'm looking forward to it more now after it's turned out to be apparently this massive train wreck than I was before. That's the honest to God truth. Maybe now it'll at least be entertaining in some way. What?
Do you think at any point it occurred to someone? Do you think that at any point it occurred to anyone that perhaps a character who cannot speak would not make for an interesting television character?
No, I don't think it occurred to anyone.
Well, one, I have to ask you, we're excited about Inhumans because of how bad it is, or you are anyway, mm-hmm. Allegedly is. We don't know that it is. We haven't watched it yet.
If it's not, I'm going to be really disappointed.
What are you more excited about, Inhumans sucking or the report that as of this season, The Walking Dead will be allowed to use F-bombs?
I'm more excited about Inhuman sucking because apparently if you read the details of the report, and maybe I misread this, but they're only allowed 2 F-bombs per season. Is that correct?
Yes. That appears to be the case based on an agreement that was made with Fear the Walking Dead, which is allowed 2 F-bombs per season. Walking Dead, its cousin, presumably is now under that same rule, which has to be somewhat disappointing for those who were hoping to hear Negan.
They both have to be Negans, right? Like, they both of them have to go to Negan, don't they?
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. Or the revelation that the character Sully from Commando survived and exists in the Walking Dead universe, in which he can use a colorful F-bomb, and I'd be fine with that. But overall, it's a very surprising thing, I think, Nick. I didn't really think this was anything that was at any point on the board. Did you?
No, I didn't either. Apparently, I've heard, though, that Preacher got away with it this season, which I haven't watched the season of Preacher yet, or finished the season of Preacher, I should say. So I'm looking forward to doing that and seeing how they use it.
Indeed.
Has to be a hair star, right?
Oh, unquestionably. Unquestionably. If it's not, then it's the biggest missed opportunity in the world. Now, I haven't seen the show's version of Hairstar, so I don't know how close to the comic book version.
Nor have I. I have high hopes, though. I've heard good things, put it that way.
Me too. Well, in the pantheon of comic book adaptations, certainly Walking Dead is wildly successful. Preacher is one that we'll be talking about when we get around to watching it soon. And there's also Watchmen, which was, of course, turned into a divisive, but in our opinion, excellent 2009 film by Zack Snyder.
And a divisive, but in our opinion, excellent audio adaptation in 2017 by the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Is it really divisive?
I would have to assume so, that that it is somewhat divisive, at least to a certain extent. I don't know that to be true.
But I would think
there's at least a small divide. There's the small group of people who have listened to it, and there's the massive amount of people who haven't. So at least there's a divide in the audience there.
True. True. But I would suggest that anyone who has listened to it, there would be two camps. There would be the people who adored it and thought it was the greatest thing they've ever heard, and there would be the people who are wrong.
Yes, I would agree with that.
But Watchmen is, believe it or not, Nick, and I thought that we were putting the definitive statement on Watchmen adaptations. Apparently there's going to be another one. We've already seen the 2009 film. We've seen our audio adaptation. We've seen a motion comic. And we've seen, of course, the classic Watchmen Rorschach. Mm-hmm. Well, now HBO has officially ordered a pilot for a Watchmen adaptation for a potential – full season, according to Variety. Damon Lindelof, who is heading it up, has revealed that the first day of pre-production has already begun on Watchmen. He hasn't said who's joining him in the Watchmen writers' room. So, Nick, you're a big Watchmen fan, despite what we've done to it on the airwaves, and I'm a big Watchmen fan.
All right.
What are your thoughts on HBO doing this Watchmen series?
You know, honestly, if you rewind the clocks, Greg, let's go back 15 years. And let's say that you and I were sitting there in 2002 and we were both aware of Watchmen and its revered status as potentially the greatest graphic novel of all time. If someone came to you and said, we're going to do it, but we're going to do it as a premium cable television series as opposed to a feature-length film, wouldn't you kind of think that would be the best approach? Because if you're looking for what you are seeking is a strict adaptation of the source material, you can't make a 13-hour long movie. I know Peter Jackson has attempted to push that limit at times, but it's physically very difficult to make a 13-hour long movie. Theaters aren't going to book it, people aren't going to sit through it, et cetera, et cetera. So doing it like this on the surface seems like really the best way to possibly do it. However, I am going to say at this moment, I am not a fan, and here are three reasons why. One, I feel like the Zack Snyder film, while not being 100% accurate, was about as good as you can do an overly reverent adaptation of it. It sought to capture all the big moments from the book. It sought to be as accurate as it could possibly be, made very few changes, and I would argue did it in a fashion that was very well made. Two, the involvement of Damon Lindelof. And I say that having not seen, what is it, Greg, The Leftovers, I believe, that is his, is his show that has earned rave reviews in recent years. I haven't seen that. However, I did watch Lost, and I did watch Prometheus. And while both of those had some redeeming qualities, I would argue that the writing was not the redeeming quality of either of those films, and why it gives me major pause that Damon Lindelof is overseeing this. Three, HBO has shown a tendency to take even its concepts that would seem to be tailor-made for one-and-dones, True Detective, not one-and-done in this instance, but Game of Thrones seems to be something that has a natural end, and they're already optioning multiple spinoffs of it. Westworld, for example, is going to be a multi-season thing. So my concern becomes them trying to artificially extend it past what should be, on its surface, one 12 to 13 episode now. So,
Do you feel that this is a direct response to American Gods?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't think so, because I would think if you wanted to make a direct response to American Gods, you'd want to pick something that hadn't really been done or hadn't been done so soon. I mean, we're only 8 years removed from that Watchmen film. I would think if you're going to go Alan Moore, something like V for Vendetta, which has had a lot more time between it, would make more sense as a television property. But, you know, I don't know what their approach is. I don't know how they're going to differentiate themselves from Zack Snyder's film. I don't know if they're going to put new spins on the source material. I don't know how they're doing it. But I'm going to say I can see the potential here, but at this moment I am not overly in favor of it.
Just trust Damon Lindelof. He has an end game.
No.
He has an end game, Nick.
He's never had an end game.
I'm kind of on the same boat with you. I feel like we've had so many Watchmen adaptations now in recent years, and just Watchmen coverage with before Watchmen a few years ago, that it almost gets in danger. And with the upcoming comic book event, Doomsday Clock, it almost gets to the point of you're in danger of overexposing what was at one time a standalone comic book and kind of stretching it beyond its natural limits. And what else do you have really to say that the film didn't say? So I don't know. I'm kind of like you. I'm not super pumped about it. Now, will I watch it? Of course.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Of course. It's Watchmen. Of course I'll watch it. But I am also approaching it in a trepidatious manner, as are you.
Exactly.
Another thing that I am approaching in a trepidatious manner is the Flash film, as we enter the DCEU corner.
DCEU corner.
Now, Nick, I know this is a little bit out of order from what we had planned, but let's roll with it. The Flash movie has gotten its new script, but it still doesn't have a director. Now, the Flash movie, titled Flashpoint, it has had its share of setbacks, certainly. But according to Variety film reporter Justin Kroll, the script has arrived in the hands of the Warner executives. But the script by Joby Harold, what a name, still doesn't have a director. So the word is that there are no plans to fast-track this. They're taking their time with this project, which I think is good news, Nick. I think this is a project they need to take their time with. They need to make sure they have the right script, first of all. They need to look it over, make sure it's what they want, make sure it's good, and take their time finding the right director. Right now, Robert Zemeckis is a hot name, especially since word came out that Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who had been rumored to go back to the project, are not going to be able to do that on account of them doing another adaptation of a book titled Artemis. So it's still a project very much in flux, but I guess it's a good sign that they have a new script, right?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a good sign. It sounds like finally some progress being made. Of course, then again, we've had how many different, you know, scripts seemingly in place for this film over the course of its development history. As I've said,
the answer to that would be some.
Yes, as I've said, I think that at this point, Flashpoint is something of a priority for Warner Brothers in a way that the Flash film probably hasn't been for a while. I think it is probably going to play a pretty key role in whatever their larger story is going to be. So I think this time it's finally going to see a lot of momentum, and I think we're going to see it placed on the front burner for the first time in a long time. And so I'm optimistic this one's finally going to see some forward motion, and I am fully on board with the idea of Robert Zemeckis. Bring it on.
Zemeckis, yes, that would be very interesting. What has he done in recent years?
Don't know, don't care.
Well, let's hope he's still got the magic touch if he comes back to do it. And another individual that does seem to have the magic touch is actress Michelle Williams, Academy Award nominated actress Michelle Williams. Why are we talking about her on a comic book podcast? Because she has reportedly signed on to star opposite Tom Hardy in Sony's upcoming Venom movie by director Ruben Fleischer. The sources indicate that, this is according to Variety, that she will play a district attorney and possibly Tom Hardy's love interest. Now, I thought this was interesting because Michelle Williams and Tom Hardy share a comic book bond and that they have some connections to the Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy. Tom Hardy, of course, playing Bane, and Michelle Williams, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, was the wife at one time of Heath Ledger.
Yes, that's correct.
Who, of course, played a character in one of the Christopher Nolan movies.
Oh, hey, by the way, Greg, most recently Robert Zemeckis has done that film Allied with Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard.
Oh, yes, which I haven't
film,
seen.
The Walk, that had Joseph Gordon-Levitt speaking French and walking across a long distance.
Also haven't seen it and probably never will.
The film Flight, starring Denzel Washington.
Ooh, wanted to see that, but didn't.
And before that, it had been a few years, he had done those motion capture adaptations of A Christmas Carol and Beowulf.
Yes, haven't seen either one of them. But needless to say, there's some movies in there that I want to see. But yeah, Michelle Williams will be in Sony's Venom. Your thoughts, Nick?
Don't really have many. I'm not. You know, I know who Michelle Williams is, but I couldn't tell you a single notable performance of hers. You know, that I've seen anyway. Like, it's one of those
she
people
was
who like
she was nominated for the movie Manchester by Sea, which I haven't seen.
I have no interest in ever watching. Like, it's just it's one of those movies that, quite frankly, not my cup of tea. I'm looking at her filmography right now to see, you know, what if anything I have ever actually seen her in, and the answer is I saw her in Halloween H2O 20 years later and didn't even know she was in it. So that's all
she
I got. For
she must have been very young in that movie.
I don't know. Apparently she played Molly Cartwell, whoever the hell that was. So I know nothing about Michelle Williams as an actress, but you know what? She's got some bona fides, as they say. As you just mentioned, she was nominated for an Oscar, so
well,
sounds like a pretty good get for Venom. Are we under that assumption?
She tends to go to a style of movie that you're a big fan of, stuff like Prozac Nation, okay. Synecdoche, New York.
I don't even want to know. Let's move on.
Shutter Island. You watched Shutter Island.
I did not watch Shutter Island. I watched fucking Synecdoche, New York, or whatever the fuck. God damn it. You got me all pissed off talking about that movie.
Okay, Gold Dust. Jeez.
Let me put it to you in terms only you and I, maybe two other people, will understand. Synecdoche, New York is my running with scissors. I'll put it that way.
Oh, yeah.
Good
Lord.
Dude, like, so fucking bad, in my opinion.
And that's what counts on this show, is our opinion. Well, there's one other thing left to get to on the rundown, and that is a story that I have complex feelings on.
Wait just a minute. I cannot resist, Greg. Let's go back to Schenectady, New York for just a minute.
Okay.
I clicked on the Wikipedia article for it, and I want to know this will give you an indication, Greg, of how full of shit this movie was. The story and themes of Schenectady, New York polarized critics. Some film critics, Greg, film critics called it pretentious and self-indulgent. I think I've said all I need to say about Schenectady, New York, and we're going to move on.
And one of them was Armand White.
One of them was Roger Ebert, so there you go.
There you have it. Very good.
I think I've said all that needs to be said about that horseshit film.
well. Tell us how you really feel about it, Nick.
It sucks. It should turn itself in.
Is it fat?
It's fat, lazy, and thinks it understands pain.
Not ugly.
No, it is ugly. It's not beautiful. It's not beautiful, Greg. It tries so damn hard to be beautiful, but it's not.
It didn't leave viscous fluid between two layers.
No. Let's not.
In any event, the one item left to talk about is one that I do, as I mentioned, have mixed feelings on. And that is that Marvel made it official this week in the series Legacy, I believe. We are going to be seeing the return, the long awaited return of the character that was killed for real, for sure, dead a few years ago. The character of Wolverine. But which Wolverine, you might ask? Well, that would be a simple answer. That would be Logan. Which Logan, you might ask? Very simple answer. That would be present day, was dead, and is now coming back to life, Logan. So real Logan, Wolverine, is coming back from the dead. And he's 100% real, by the way. This is not a hologram. This is not a part of a living cosmic cube that is in a subconscious that will come out and be split in half, as far as we know. This is the real Wolverine, the only Wolverine, except not the only Wolverine. Because he will be coming back, and he will be joining fellow Wolverines, Old Man Logan, X-23, and your favorite character, Nick, that you're so fond of reminding me of, Jimmy Hudson.
For fuck's sake.
Nick, your thoughts on the return of I don't know why I'm asking you. You're not the big Wolverine fan here, but I will anyway. Your thoughts on the return of Wolverine and the new status quo of four Wolverines.
I have no real thoughts on the return of the classic Wolverine, seeing as how I don't really read X-Men titles and haven't read an Avengers title in a long time either, which are pretty much the only two places I would encounter him. So this doesn't really affect me in the least. I do think the idea of four Wolverines running around at the same time is really stupid. But, I don't know. This is one of those things where I look at it and I acknowledge that it's dumb, but I have a hard time getting real bent out of shape about it, if that makes sense.
I'm just the one thing that – on the one hand, it makes me excited because Wolverine, as many know, is my favorite Marvel character, and it's not close. He is my favorite Marvel character by several leaps. And so that you would think that I would be very happy about this. However, I am all about whatever serves the story, whatever makes sense, whatever works for the universe as a whole in terms of making a better storytelling experience. And in this case, the better storytelling experience would be for Wolverine to stay dead for now. A, to build up more intrigue for him to come back. I don't think anybody's really begging for it right now, given the saturation of the character with regards to Old Man Logan, with regards to Laura, with regards to whoever Jimmy is. I still don't really understand. My deal on that is that. But
Jimmy – Jimmy, Greg, in addition to being that Peckerwood boy up the street, is the son of the ultimate Wolverine.
Uh-huh.
No, in the Ultimate Universe, Wolverine apparently had a long-lost son that nobody knew about conveniently until he was dead. And then they brought him in as the lead of a miniseries written by Jeff Loeb called Ultimate X that dealt with the recreation of the X-Men in the wake of another series written by Jeff Loeb, Ultimatum, and an incognito Jean Grey went and located this Jimmy Hudson and revealed to him his true parentage and offered him an opportunity to carry on his father's legacy in a reformed version of the X-Men.
Does he happen to have the same powers as his father?
Yes, of course he does, Greg.
I thought the Ultimate Universe got destroyed. Why is this motherfucker coming over into the 616?
Because the Ultimate Universe got destroyed, but they are picking and choosing their things that they want to keep around.
But why him?
For example, Miles Morales, probably the most notable example. They kept Miles Morales around. They are also keeping around heel Reed Richards, which is a good thing, as the character of the Maker, which is actually the best version of Reed Richards. I said it. Come at me, Kelly Puhle. Reed Richards blows. This guy, for some unknown fucking reason. That's right. We've got Jimmy fucking Hudson. Instead of, like, Ultimate Kitty Pryde or any of the numerous other Ultimate characters that could actually provide something useful to the Marvel Universe.
Well, in any event, the one good thing about this, though, Nick, is now we've got two Logans, Old Man Logan and Regular Logan, and we've got two Jean Greys. As we mentioned in the last episode, Regular Jean Grey and time-displaced Young Jean Grey. So now we can do the really creepy thing and hook up Old Man Logan with Young Jean Grey and Regular Logan with Regular Jean Grey. Then they can cross-pollinate and have Logan cheat on Regular Jean Grey with Young Jean Grey and Old Man Logan cheat on Young Jean Grey with Regular Jean Grey.
Yes.
Thus creating a Jean Grey-Logan quadrangle.
A little menage a trois?
Yes! Como say,
how
menage
you say,
a trois.
How you say public relation?
Relation. Mila Jovovic? You could easily do that, and that makes perfect sense and is what should happen. But in all seriousness, I love Wolverine. I think he's an amazing character. I think I never bought into the death of Wolverine to begin with.
Well, okay, but –
but
wait, no, okay.
I don't really get the saturation thing and taking away all the things that made Wolverine and Logan as a character interesting to begin with.
And I agree with that, but like to say that you didn't buy into the death, like we don't buy into any comics death at this point. I mean like the point – we know – like before the character is ever killed, we all know, each and every one of us know – that the character will be back within 5 years. Like, that is a commonly accepted fact.
Which begs the question, why do it?
Because it's just, it's a trope.
It's
not
creative.
It is a time-honored tradition in
this business. It's only been for like 20 years. It wasn't before. It's not like in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you didn't constantly get the death of freaking every character in the book to stretch it out another 5 years, you know, like every two storylines wasn't everybody mourning the death of Captain America in the 70s, 80s.
Although we have been killing off Jean Grey and resurrecting her for the better part of like 30
years. That
was
a Jean Grey thing. There's a reason it's associated with Jean Grey and not associated with the entire Marvel universe. Because Jean Grey, it was special when she came back.
Captain Marvel, did we not?
No, Captain Marvel stayed dead the whole time. See, death of Captain Marvel was a big deal because he stayed dead. Death of Jean Grey was a big deal because they brought her back and then killed her again and then brought her back.
But death of Mighty Thor, which apparently is happening in the over the next few months. Like
another example.
She'll be dead, and I don't even think that one will last. Jane Foster will be dead less than a year, in my opinion.
Well, and not only that, but they've shown her in teaser images of the upcoming series. So.
Right, because the storyline, the death of the Mighty Thor, starts in like 2 months.
So, you know, I don't know. I never thought it was a compelling death storyline. I never thought it was.
I didn't read it, so I can't.
Natural.
You know, it didn't make any sense. The whole idea of the character.
I don't have anything against Charles. I think Charles Soule was forced to write that, my suspicion. And probably did as good as he could with it.
Yeah.
But it was just not anything that I cared to see. I was like, I don't need to see this. I've seen the death of Wolverine, and I done better before in the past. And you know, I wasn't into that whole deal to begin with. But bringing him back right now just doesn't seem like the right time. I don't like it. I don't really understand a lot of the moves that Marvel is doing right now. So I don't know. But as a Wolverine fan. This gets a big for me.
Yeah, I'm about the same.
And that does it for the rundown, folks. The weekly news and notes happenings in the comic book world. But some of what we talked about may be brought up in our next segment because we're about to get to your favorite segment and ours, the longest running segment on the longest running weekly comic book podcast at Place to Be Nation.
You forgot episodic.
Episodic. Comic book podcast at Place to Be Nation.
In all of Place to Be Nation.
In all of Place to Be Nation.
We've got to protect our trademark, Greg. I mean, we only have it trademarked a certain way.
Intellectual property, my friends. I understand the Young Bucks have been using some of our catchphrases.
Yeah, we're going to send them a cease and desist here pretty soon.
Exactly. Our attorney, Gerald McDevitt, is getting on it.
He's never heard of a comic book and denies their very existence.
That's right. We are ready for the segment where we talk about what we've been reading and watching. It's called
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Exactly. So, you want to start with reading or watching this week, Nick?
Let's start with watching, Greg.
All right, very good. I watched an episode of Luke Cage.
Oh, my God. All right. I was joking because I haven't watched anything, but please go right ahead.
I watched episode 7 of Luke Cage. I can't remember what the title was of it. But this was the first episode of Luke Cage. Not the first one that I haven't liked, because remember I mentioned I think it was episode 4 that I wasn't crazy about that told his origin. And I thought it was a pretty weak episode. But this is the first episode, and I'm not even saying I didn't like the episode. The episode I thought was amazing. This was an episode that it may be the greatest example I can think of on television of an episode that is 95% amazing and then ruins it with the finish. Because this was the episode in which Cottonmouth – spoiler alert, ladies and gentlemen – Cottonmouth – meets his end in this episode and in the most anticlimactic manner imaginable for a character of this magnitude, because this episode also gives us the origin of Cottonmouth, and it's awesome. I thought this episode was on route, Nick, and this is timely from our countdown a few weeks ago. This was on route to becoming one of my top 5 episodes of the Marvel Netflix universe. It was that good. His acting was that good. And the young version of Cottonmouth was that good. This showed you his environment that he grew up in and how he really could have become something special. He was a talented musician who was on a route to escape all of this crime and pettiness that his aunt was bringing him into. And instead, because of his aunt, he's sucked into that life and he can't escape it. And he's drawn into the filth and the grime, and he's literally turned into a murderer and has to kill the one guy that gave him a chance and gave him belief in himself. And he still regrets it to this day. And it was a masterclass in acting, and they threw it away, in my opinion, for an inferior character in his cousin, the politician. And they threw it away to set up Diamondback, who I understand from others is an inferior character. They threw away one of the very best Marvel villains, and it is, to me, in my opinion, one of the biggest missteps in the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe at this point. I would put it right up there alongside bringing Phil Coulson back to life as a misstep. It really upset me. It really upset me, Nick.
Yeah. I knew you were getting pretty close to the point at which I feel like the entire season of Luke Cage takes an irreversible turn for the worst, and I am interested to hear your thoughts going forward. I think that a large part of the appeal of the show, Mike Coulter is great, don't get me wrong, but Mahershala Ali and his portrayal of Cottonmouth is, in my opinion, the finest portrayal in that show, and the show suffered massively after his departure. So interested to see what your take on the back half of the season is.
Yeah, I'm not really looking forward to it because I was really looking to see more of Luke and Cottonmouth's interactions, especially since Cottonmouth finally seemed to get Luke under his thumb in this episode. But my question for you is, which do you prefer, Mahershala Ali or the modern-day Mahershala Ali?
Well, the modern-day Mahershala Ali is going to voice Aaron Davis, a.k.a. the Prowler, in the animated Miles Morales movie. So Given my massive love for Miles Morales, I'll take the modern day Mahershala Ali.
Absolutely. Do you think that we could become the Sumer and Sunil Singh of the modern day Mahershala Ali?
No, because you see, Sumer and Sunil Singh have something in common with Jinder Mahal, and I don't think that you and I have much in common with Mr. Mahershala Ali.
Other than our crushingly good looks and immense talent.
Crushingly good looks and rock-hard physiques, of course.
Exactly. Well, that's about it for watching. I hadn't watched a darn tootin' thing else.
Nor have I.
But,
nor have I.
But one thing I know you've been doing a lot of and I've been doing a little of is reading.
Whew. How do we want to handle this?
How are we going to handle it? You want to do just a bunch of quick hits? You want to do your top three, bottom one?
I can't do a top three, bottom one because, folks, I read 24 comic books this week. That's right,
24 comic books.
And still have like half a stack left to read. So I tried my best to get caught up, and it just couldn't happen.
In other words, he read a calendar year's worth of comic books in my world.
I read I legitimately read about a month's worth of comics. So here's what I'll do. I will give you my thoughts on the titles in general that I read. I may have read multiple issues of some of these, but I will try to hit the highlights here. And I will start going back to an event series from Marvel Comics that we have discussed numerous times here on these very airwaves. Mm-hmm. And I know it's one that I controversially had been holding up as being defending it. I've been a defender of Secret Empire. And so the last one I was able to discuss here on these airwaves many weeks ago was Secret Empire number 8. I have now read Secret Empire number 9, Secret Empire number 10, and Secret Empire Omega, which was a one-shot that was served as kind of an epilogue to the entire thing. And I got to say, I still enjoyed it. I don't feel like the finale had the highs of the first 8 issues, or more specifically of like the first 6 to 7 issues. I think 8 is where it kind of started to peter off a little bit. But I will say, it's still a very well-written and well-drawn book. The ending was very predictable. It's an ending that I had seen coming a mile away. But I will say the journey to get there was still pretty fun, and I think Secret Empire, for my money, ultimately goes down as one of the better Marvel events in the past, in the modern Marvel event era, I would argue.
Wow.
But
you didn't find – now, I've read many of the pages from the last issue. You didn't – you, of all people, you didn't – Mr. Anti-Superman, you didn't find that corny in the least?
The showdown between the two Captains of America?
The two Caps, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was. It was, undoubtedly. But the things that were going on around it were what I was able to find some solace in, because the character interactions were what really helped me to enjoy the book so much, and I felt like it kept those – consistent in terms of the other interactions surrounding that climactic battle. But that climactic battle, Greg, was what I assumed was going to happen the entire time. Like
a physical fist fight between
Yes,
two
as soon as they
America.
Introduced the idea of a second Steve Rogers out there very early on in the series, I assumed that there was going to be a physical showdown between the two characters. Yes. Mm. I mean, I understand why people have skepticism towards it, and I'm not knocking that at all. I mean, I get it. But this is what comics do. They have these sort of endings. At the end of the day, they tend to find these magical reset buttons to set everything back to status quo. And not that this isn't quite status quo. There are still some lasting effects of this. The living cosmic cube Kobik ultimately did set things right, but she didn't take away the memory of what happened. So the public still has a very deep distrust of the idea of Captain America. And Hydra now kind of has this new purpose.
Even though the Captain America they don't trust didn't do anything.
Yes, but they have they are now wary of placing their full trust in anyone. You know, it's kind of this thing of they've mm-hmm. been burned before, and so it's this whole deal. Mm-hmm. But now this Hydra Cap makes the point in the Omega epilogue issue that Hydra now isn't fighting for something that they never had. They now believe that they are fighting for something that was unjustly taken away from them, because right or wrong or indifferent, all of Hydra now believes that the allies used the cosmic cube to alter history, even though that is not what actually happened. And they are fighting to, in their opinion, take back their world/their country. So continuing the political parallels between the Marvel Universe and our current American landscape. So, you know, it didn't hit the highs of the previous parts of the series, but I still enjoyed it overall, I would say.
Fair enough.
Moving on to DC's current major event, and I read DC Metal number 2. And I liked it. I did not love it. I know that we have had Place to Be Nation compatriots, Todd Weber and Russell Sellers, who have been effusive in their praise for Metal to this point, and I can understand that to a certain level. But for me, for a Batman-centric story, crazy cosmic adventures are not my style, not my preferred take on Batman. I will say that Scott Snyder writes these crazy out there concepts better than certain other individuals. I don't feel the need to say their name right now. But still, ultimately, when it comes down to it, this is not my ideal Batman story, even if I can still enjoy aspects of it. So I'm liking Metal. I'm not loving it to this point the way many are. Jessica Jones, number 12. I've wrapped up the Lies of Maria Hill storyline, or the Secrets of Maria Hill. I forget what it was actually called. This storyline wrapped up in very satisfactory fashion. Continue that trend of swapping the art to reflect a change in time, and sets up a hell of a cliffhanger for the return of the Purple Man, which is coming in the next issue, and should be a very intriguing storyline.
Something else that was a hell of a cliffhanger, the movie cliffhanger.
Indeed. Batman, I caught up on the War of Jokes and Riddles, and I got to say, man, right now, this Batman title is firing on all cylinders. I'm still not in love with Tom King and the way he writes the Joker, but literally everything else about the book is outstanding. It's the best version of the Riddler, in my opinion, that has been put on the page. And yes, that includes the Scott Snyder version seen in Zero Year. But it also has taken the character of Kite Man, who was nothing but a joke, and turned him into a legitimately sympathetic, relatable, and understandable human being. And not just a one-note joke. And it's an outstanding example of character reclamation on the part of Tom King.
The Johnsian approach to villains.
Absolutely. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, I caught up on that. I am in the midst of this Fall of the Gods storyline, which is a new God-centric storyline where these giant new God-killing machines seemingly are on their are on the warpath trying to take out the new gods. And again, this is something I like. I don't love it. I've never been the world's biggest fan of the new gods. I've never gone back and actually read the original Kirby stuff. I'm not a huge fan of that era, you know, the 70s of DC. But I can admit this is still a pretty good story, but to me it's a little bit of a drop-off from the recent how stuff that's been going on and Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. Aquaman, Red 28, this continues to be one of the best-written and best-drawn books in comics, and that's really all I want to say about it. It's outstanding. Spider-Man 2, number 3, reveals the backstory of the 616 Miles Morales, Miles doppelganger, and it's okay. Not exactly what I was expecting, a little underwhelming, but they got a couple more issues to land the plane, so to speak. So still hanging on to this one. Detective Comics, read a good bit of Detective Comics, loving this. They continue to have a very intriguing take on Clayface. They are showing us his internal struggle with trying to contain the monster within. And on a bonus note, I get to see Anarchy get the ever-living shit kicked out of him, which is always a good thing, in my opinion, because Anarchy sucks as a character. Green Arrow, caught up on that. This is bringing the hard-traveling hero story to a close. I get to see him interact with Hal Jordan, and I think Ben Percy writes a hell of an Ollie and Hal dynamic, and also get to see him kind of wrap up this hard-traveling hero storyline by having him interact with the Justice League as a whole in a very satisfactory fashion that does not feel out of character for either Ollie or the rest of the league. So I know you're not as high on Green Arrow, but I continue to love it. Let's see here. Green Lanterns, wrapping up the Out of Time storyline and the story involving the first 7 Lanterns. We get to see kind of Volthoom ultimately is his own worst enemy, because kind of through some wacky time travel rules, he winds up creating the Green Lantern Corps and leading to his downfall at the hands of Simon and Jessica. He's still out there, They still have to ultimately take him down, but his plans get foiled basically because of his own foolishness. So that's kind of cool. Spider-Man number 20 kind of takes on a new little brief status quo for the book as Miles has decided to take some much-needed R&R and head to a city he's always wanted to see. So the next little bit of this book is going to have Miles in Tokyo. And I really like this one. This artist, Leon, I enjoyed this different artist, and Bendis continues to write Miles better than anybody else, mainly because nobody else gets to write him. And let's move on to Star Wars. I got to read two issues of Star Wars plus an annual. Not really much to say here. Jason Aaron's run is about to wrap up, and he is kind of doing these little one-off stories. He did a one-off Han Solo story, a one-off R2 story, and then handed the ball over to his Southern Bastards collaborator, Jason Latour, to write the annual. And all of these were really great standalone Star Wars stories. I would recommend them to anyone who may not be reading the current series but just wants to pick up a Star Wars book. You can pick up any of these. That's 35, 36, or annual number 3. Don't have to be following the larger continuity to enjoy these stories. All-Star Batman 13, getting ready to wrap up the first Ally storyline, finally revealing who the first Ally is and what his connection is to Alfred in particular. And again, this is a storyline that's been good, but hasn't been great. I would say that, honestly, outside of the second story arc, which was the one that kind of featured rotating villains and rotating artists, All-Star Batman as a whole has been a little underwhelming. It's still been solid, but not what I would expect from Scott Snyder, given his work with Greg Capullo, and certainly not what I would expect for a $4.99 price tag on each of these issues. And then finally, I read the Iron Man and Ironheart Generations one-shot. Very good, including an alternate future take on Tony Stark that I did not see coming and very much enjoyed. I don't want to spoil it at all for anyone, but if you're even the slightest fan of Brian Michael Bendis's Iron Man run, go check out this Generations one-shot. And finally, just this very afternoon, Greg, as you and I have already discussed, I read the much-anticipated, much-hyped Marvel Legacy number 1. This was their 64-page one-shot meant to serve much the same purpose as the DC Universe Rebirth number 1 did for DC back last year, to kick off Marvel's new publishing initiative, to kind of set a new status quo for the Marvel Universe, to set up the stories that are going to be told across that universe in the months to come. And I will say that I ultimately liked it. I did not love it. It certainly was not an accomplishment on the level of the DC Universe Rebirth special, which was clearly what
the DC Universe Rebirth special, baby.
Which is clearly what it was attempting to the formula it was attempting to copy. And the reason for that is, while the DC Universe Rebirth special undoubtedly showed you different snippets from across the universe and kind of showed you these different stories that would be playing out in various titles, it also had a unifying theme and a unifying story of this mystery of the lost time, you know, and talking about these aspects, these ideas, these thoughts, these themes, again, that had been missing from the DC Universe basically since the advent of the New 52. And so while it had, you know, it kind of hopped around from place to place in the DC Universe, it still felt like a collective narrative. And I got to say, in my opinion, this one, it felt like a bunch of fairly entertaining, unconnected interludes. I know that they were supposed to be connected in some way, but I feel like the connections weren't as firmed up as they were in the DC Universe, in the Rebirth one-shot. So, enjoyed it overall, but left me wanting a bit more, and I don't know that it did what it was setting out to do in terms of getting me to buy into Legacy as a whole. I'm still going to probably read the same books I was reading pre-Legacy and maybe try one or two here or there, but in terms of getting me to buy into Marvel's entire publishing line the way Rebirth did last year with DC, gotta say it didn't quite pass that test for me.
Very good. Do you find that Preparation H works on the whole?
I've never had that problem, but I will ask Mr. Tim Capel next time I talk to him.
Telling tales out of school. Come on, man. That's neither here nor there. I am currently tossing into the air a pillow that is in the shape of a giant pile of poo. So that is fun.
Is that your official Enzo Amore pillow?
You know what, Nick? We've gone this entire episode without bringing up anything that would be a sore spot for either one of us, and you're bringing up Enzo Amore in the midst of all this. Why would you do that, Nick? Why would you bring him up?
Because you're tossing up your poop emoji pillow, and Enzo Amore wears the poop emoji. You and he share a love for the poop emoji.
Listen, the very fact that I have anything in common with Enzo Amore, Amore even, makes me want to throw myself off my second floor balcony and do what I would assume to be a very slight amount of damage to myself.
Then you can get up and do the Enzo shuffle before walking away.
For God's sake. You mean the George Clooney and Oh Brother Where Art Thou shuffle?
Sure.
We live in a world, ladies and gentlemen, where many things that probably shouldn't be happening are happening. And one of those things is that Enzo Amore is a champion.
He's a champion.
A champion, even.
I lived through the Naomi era, Greg. You too will live through the Enzo Amore era.
Don't even comparing Naomi, lovely Naomi, to Enzo is a disgrace.
The god awful Naomi, as I have called her for many months.
That's not that is a harsh assessment of the.
But an accurate one. But an accurate
of a fine
one.
A fine young woman.
Yeah.
Who?
She's a handsome young lady.
Are you saying she's the Tom Zink of women's wrestlers?
I'm saying she is the Evan Courageous of women's wrestlers.
Nothing happening, Evan Courageous. Wow. Right.
Nothing happening, Naomi. There it is. There it is. Nothing happening, Naomi. I like it.
Well, I have comic books that I've read this week, and I am going to start with my bottom one. I have four comics that I read, so I have a bottom one and I'll have a top three. My bottom one is not a bad comic at all, actually, just the worst of the ones that I read. And that is Green Arrow number 18, which is part one of The Return of Roy Harper. And as the title would indicate, this is about the return to Seattle of Roy Harper.
No, I don't think it is quite yet. Is this not still on the Indian reservation?
Yeah, no. This is actually him returning to a Spokane, Washington Indian reservation.
Mm-hmm. But you get the rebirth version. They start to flashback and show you
the current
version of he and Ollie's the origin of their relationship, right?
And it's a very Jason Todd and Bruce Wayne type origin, right, where he actually tries to rob Oliver Queen, and that's how they first meet one another. Ollie wonders how he learned to operate a bow and takes him under his wing and perhaps his wang, but that's not shown on panel. And they start to work together. And even from the beginning, there's tension between them. Their personalities are different. They view things differently, but they also seem to be having fun. But yet we find out through the current day that something went wrong along the way. At some point, they became at odds with one another, and there's still a harsh relationship there, as we see by the end of the comic. And I thought this was good. This is Ben Percy, of course, writing, and the art is by Eleonora Carlini. And I thought the art was serviceable. Not great, not tremendous, but serviceable. The writing, to me, is pretty good. It's not the best in the world, but it's good. It's solid. And I like the dynamic between the two characters. I find it interesting. I think the DC Universe is better when these two characters have a chance to interact with one another, which is something the New 52 gave us very little of.
You may not know the answer to this, Greg, but let me ask you, has Indian or Native American heritage always been an aspect of Roy Harper's character? Because I feel like this is the first time I've ever encountered that within this story.
Well, to be honest, in my Green Arrow readings, I haven't encountered Roy Harper a lot.
That's true. Good point.
So I don't know. I honestly can't answer that. My Roy Harper knowledge is very limited. The one thing I can tell you is a recent Roy Harper edition is him wearing a freaking baseball cap all the time. A stupid-ass look that should have been done away with when Rebirth happened.
Was that line that I love so good in this book?
Which one?
There is a line at some point in the story where Roy says something to Ollie like, I see you've grown a ridiculous goatee. And he said, and Ollie says, I'm not really gonna take fashion advice from the guy who's wearing a backwards baseball cap.
No, that hasn't happened yet, but I look forward to it. That sounds awesome.
It's coming.
But no, this book both reminds me of the two of the worst fashion adaptation or evolutions of the New 52, the backwards hat and regular hat wearing Arsenal, and the goggle wearing Green Arrow as we see in the past.
Goggle.
Not good, but the book itself is good. I liked it. I thought this was much better than the Last Outlaw story arc. So good start to the return of Roy Harper. Sorry to take so long talking about that.
You're all right.
My number three book of the time period is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 14, by Robert Venditti and Rafa Sandoval. And this has a great cover, by the way, of Hal Jordan on one side, Kyle Rayner on the other, and they're looking over the shoulders of a meditating Saint Walker, who is one of our favorite Green Lantern side characters. And as the cover indicates, this is primarily about Hal and Kyle trying to find Saint Walker on this seemingly abandoned planet. And also, while that's going on, Guy Gardner finds the rarely seen DC character Space Cabby, and John Stewart and Soren Ignatiu try to bring together the Green Lantern and Sinestro Corps to work together. And this is the first part of the Quest for Hope story arc, and it was great. I really enjoyed every aspect of this book. I thought the writing was great, the characterizations were on point, the art was wonderful. The only thing that I didn't like is how Rafael Sandoval draws Soren Ignatiu to have Conway Twitty hair.
I did not know that at all until you said that.
As your business grows,
other than Soren's Conway Twitty hair, this was a great comic book. The art was great, the writing was great. Space Cabby was a funny thing to pull in. Even Kyle is written really well, which I don't say often in comics, but I really enjoyed this take on Kyle. I like the dynamic with him and Hal working together. It was great. I'm enjoying this series tremendously. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps.
I'm glad to hear it.
Number two is another issue of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. It is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps at number 15, the very next issue, which continues the quest for hope. This one is even better than the last, as this ranking would indicate. This is drawn by the great Ethan Van Sciver, the greatest Green Lantern artist of them all, and it's tremendous. And what makes this one stand out even from the last is we get to see the indomitable wills of both Hal Jordan and Kyle Rayner as they overcome this prison that takes them – this plant – this creature, rather, that – takes them over and imprisons them within itself and forces them to see all their hopes and dreams taken away. And it even plays into the futures that were shown to us way back at the end of Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run. As Hal Jordan is married and has grandkids, he sees that future and he sees it taken away. Kyle has the long hair and he's going across the cosmos spreading life to the universe, and he sees that taken away and him warped into being Parallax again. And both of them are able to overcome this and show why they're great Green Lanterns and help their friend Saint Walker escape from this planet and head back to reality, so to speak. So that's awesome. And then the other thing that makes it great is the quest of Guy Gardner without his ring to pick a fight with a certain member of the Sinestro Corps, and that member is Arkillo. And at the end of the issue, he challenges Arkillo to a bare-knuckle brawl, as only Guy Gardner can. What an awesome issue. What a great comic. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 15.
Indeed.
And at number one, we have one of the best comic books I've read in 2017. And this comic book is Green Lanterns number 18, The Last Testament of the First Lantern. This was not just a great comic, this was an exceptional comic. This was, like I mentioned, one of the best comics I've read all year. I would put it on a short list, top five for me probably. It's certainly top 10. This tells the lost story of Volthoom, the First Lantern, as he has been seemingly killed. It takes up right after Wrath of the First Lantern, that Geoff Johns story from several years ago. And we get to find out, as he recounts to Necron his history, the true origin story of Volthoom, which has never been told before. And it's a doozy, and it's compelling, and it's, you know, it's almost like in some ways it's like Ego's. It reminded me of Ego's origin story from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 in some ways, taking you through all these different worlds and all these different planets and cultures. But instead of trying to populate the universe in his image, his motivations are much more noble. He's trying to get back and fulfill a promise to his dying mother. And that is his motivation for everything that he does until his quest causes him to go mad. And he and the Guardians become at odds with one another. And it creates yet another character who has somewhat of a case for the Guardians kind of screwing him a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really interesting how this is put together. He is both sympathetic and infinitely hateable because of the actions that he takes and his selfishness and his, as you mentioned earlier, continual missteps along his journey that he makes, you know, mistakes here and there that compound and ultimately keep him from his ultimate goals. However, it's also impossible not to blame the Guardians a little bit for his situation. We also get a reveal from Necron that promises to keep Volthoom around for years to come, as Necron reveals that Volthoom can never be killed. As long as there is an emotional spectrum, there will always be Volthoom. And so I thought this was amazing, man. I really loved it. I'm trying to see who the artist was on this one. This was Sam Humphries writing and Robson Rocha on art, and it was amazing. I can't say enough about it. And the colors, I'm trying to find out who the colorist was on this, because I thought the colors were standout. That is Alex Salazzo, and yeah, one of the best comics of the year, in my opinion.
Yeah, I as I have said to you on these airwaves, one of the most remarkable things about the Sam Humphries run on Green Lanterns is that it is taking aspects from our beloved Geoff Johns Green Lantern run and just adding to them, not taking away, but just enhancing them and making them even better. And that is remarkable when you're able to do that with something mm-hmm. as good as the Geoff Johns run. So had yep. no doubt you would love that issue when you got there.
Yep, absolutely. So with that being said, folks, that puts a wrap on that. And we are at the end of another episode here in our lush Vancouver, British Columbian studios. And Nick, why don't you tell the good folks what we have coming their way?
Well, the month of October, for the second straight year, we are going to take over in honor of both Halloween and the return of the ratings juggernaut, The Walking Dead. It is going to be Walking Dead month. That's right, a month of nothing but Walking Dead shows. We haven't quite ironed out what order we're going to do these in, simply because we just hit you with a Long Book Hunter this week, and on our current schedule, we have another Long Book Hunt next week, but I feel pretty confident we're going to wind up moving that around a little bit. But I'll tell you, over the course of October, in some order, you will hear a Long Book Hunt tentatively set to be on volumes 2 and 3 of The Walking Dead. It's a pretty short read, and plus we love kind of tearing the comic apart, honestly, so the more we can do that, the better. We're also going to give you an off-the-page looking back at the first season of the Telltale Games Walking Dead series, the first season. And then, to provide you with the counterpoint to last year's top 5 Walking Dead characters, we're going to give you a countdown of our bottom 5 Walking Dead characters, all building to the final episode in October, where we will bring back to you a special edition of the podcast, a feature-length review of The Walking Dead Season 8 premiere.
And all of this is going to come to you in the month of October, that most hallowed of months. So you have all that to look forward to. We'll be joined by our companion, our friend, Jennifer Smith, for, of course, the countdown episode. We may be joined by some other guests along the way. We'll see. And, of course, November is going to bring its own trials and tribulations as we have the releases of Thor, Ragnarok, and Justice League. So we got a lot of great stuff coming out here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We also encourage you to listen to the rest of the great podcasts here at Place to Be Nation Pop. We've got Seller's Points. We've got Geek and Sassy killing it all the time. We've got Conversation Comics as they continue to delve into Claremont and Burns' historic X-Men run. We've got Sunday Groove looking into the music industry. I will be joining Mr. Sunday soon. And I just did join him, actually, in the second episode to talk about life-changing albums for us. And I will soon be joining him to talk about a mutual band of ours that we love, the Few Fighters. And I will talk less about Garth Brooks' albums on that one than I did on the last episode. We also have a brand new episode of the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, as there's a new Star Trek series out, Star Trek Discovery. Glenn and Scott give their thoughts on that one. And, of course, there's always Lucha Undead. We've got the Best Beer Podcast. There's all kinds of
– Top Beer.
Top Beer Podcast. Top Beer, Best Beer. It's the same. It's called different things in different countries, Nick. And we've got just a variety of things, any kind of taste you could have pretty much. Sports. We've got NBA podcasts. We've got all kinds of stuff going on here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Check it all out. And if you're into the graps, as the kids say, I understand, Nick.
The graps, yes.
You can check all that out over on the wrestling side of Place to Be Nation. And they got a lot of great content there for you. And if you don't like comics or wrestling, then screw you. Well, with that being said, I am all out of stuff to talk about. Nick, so I think you're probably all out of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I'm tapped out after that long recount of my massive amount of comic reading I did this week.
Absolutely. If you have any suggestions for the show, let us know at the aforementioned social media accounts, of course. And this week I leave you with this thought. If you are a listener who by any chance has ever attended Vanderbilt University, I apologize for the actions of this past weekend. You have a good week, ladies and gentlemen.
Hard Traveling Fanboys. Got two weekly segments coming to your town. Reading, watching, and the rundown. Do-do-do-do-do-do. It's the greatest show on Place to Be Nation. Certainly a unique situation. Ooh, Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Hard traveling fanboys.
You vicious little son of a bitch.
They're indivisible. They're microwavable.
No, Mr. Eddie.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboy. Oy, 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 oy.
Are you gonna give me fucking anything on the show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question. Give me a minute.
Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely thin and well kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
I believe it was quite sudden. Okay.
Mom.
Hard traveling fanboys.
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 Hard traveling fanboys.